From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, our weekly series of favorites from the archives takes a musical turn. Charlie Rich started out writing hit songs for the likes of Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Roy Orbison, and ended up a country music star. His latest album features both new songs and jazz and R&B standards. We'll feature an interview recorded last year. Also from 92, an interview with guitarist and singer Ry Cooder. He's explored all forms of American roots music, from blues to Tex-Mex and hulas. He's done soundtracks for movies like Paris, Texas, and session work for the Rolling Stones. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Coneheads movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Dr. Joycelyn Elders faced questions from a Senate committee today that's considering her nomination to be the nation's next Surgeon General. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
The questioning never really got heated, as some people had expected, because of Elders' controversial views on abortion, sex education, and condom distribution. The committee questioned her about her financial dealings, unpaid Social Security taxes on a caretaker for her mother-in-law, for example. And she was ready with answers. On the caretaker issue, her husband was paying the worker, and he's now paid the Social Security. On her public health views, Elders sought to diffuse the concerns of some conservatives by saying that she believed that communities should decide issues about sex education and condom distribution, not the state or federal government. The committee will vote on the nomination next Friday. If they approve, it will then go to the full Senate. This is Joanne Silberner on Capitol Hill.
The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee said he expects the panel to vote on the Supreme Court nomination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg next Thursday. Confirmation hearings for the federal appeals judge ended today with praise for the nominee and no indications from any senators that they plan to vote against her. Court proceedings have begun against a man arrested in connection with a plot to bomb targets across New York and another man accused of hiding the fugitive. As Steve Inskeep reports, an FBI SWAT team captured the men in North Wildwood, New Jersey.
The FBI's Jim Esposito says the bombing suspects had rented a beachfront apartment along the Jersey Shore and appeared to be relaxing with their families.
It appeared that he and his associates were involved in some sort of a barbecue at the time that we located him there and effected his arrest.
As the FBI SWAT team approached, authorities say Madarawi Mohammed Saleh dropped his grilled steak, grabbed an 11-year-old child, and ran. The SWAT team apprehended him without violence, and they've taken him to New York to face charges that he tried to bomb New York City's Lincoln and Holland tunnels and the United Nations, among other targets. Also under arrest, Ashraf Mohammed, who faces charges of helping Saleh hide. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
The State Department is offering a $2 million reward for help in capturing a suspect charged in the World Trade Center bombing. Spokesman Mike McCurry described 26-year-old Ramzi Ahmed Youssef as extremely dangerous. He said Youssef, who's used at least 10 aliases, has fled the United States and is believed to be in the Middle East. McCurry said Youssef is considered likely to keep committing acts of terrorism if he's not caught. On Wall Street today, prices closed sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 21.5 points to close at 3,546.7. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading of 218 million shares. This is NPR. A political tug of war kept the House from passing a $3 billion emergency flood relief bill before it adjourned for the weekend today. Republicans and some conservative Democrats have been demanding that the package be paid for with cuts in other programs. They mustered enough votes today to keep the measure from coming to the floor. Democratic leaders tried unsuccessfully to work out an agreement on the bill today. It's now expected to come up again on Tuesday. Thousands of people in Des Moines, Iowa, are beginning the lengthy process of cleaning up from the worst flood in that city's history. Heavy rain is forecast throughout the weekend. From Des Moines, Mark Moran of member station WOI has more.
At 30th and Bell on Des Moines' west side, destroyed toys, appliances, and furniture litter the mud-soaked lawn at the home of Kip and Lynn Morsch. Mrs. Morsch said this flood took everything from the family of five, including some of their most prized possessions.
When you look at what used to be pictures, and it's It's a bitter rainbow of reds and greens and yellows, but there aren't any faces anymore.
Des Moines may be in for more flooding this weekend. The weather forecast calls for as much as 5 inches of rain to fall in the region, which will send river levels up again. City officials are watching closely to protect the city's water plant, which restored running water to the city just yesterday. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
The Arch Mineral Company is offering a $100,000 reward for information about the killing of a non-union worker at one of its mines in West Virginia. The worker was shot to death as he drove past a United Mine Workers picket line. It was the first bloodshed in the 10-week-old selective strike against some of the nation's biggest coal producers. UMW President Richard Trumka said he was shocked and saddened by the killing. A mine company executive charged that there was a conspiracy among the picketers to commit murder. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charlie Rich was one of country music's big stars in the 70s. But if all you know of Charlie Rich is hits like The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors, then you've only heard one side of him. He got his start as a rockabilly singer in the 50s. In the 60s, he had the novelty hit Mohair Sam, but there were many lean years in that decade. The 70s brought fame, but they also brought musical compromise. His most recent album, Pictures and Paintings, showcases him without the big orchestras and backup singers of his country years. It's just Rich and a few musicians doing songs written by Rich and his wife Margaret Ann, as well as jazz and R&B standards like Mood Indigo and You Don't Know Me. I spoke with him last year when the album was released. We're featuring this interview today as part of our weekly Fresh Air Favorites edition. Let's listen to the title song from Rich's latest album. It's a Doc Pomus, Dr. John collaboration called Pictures and Paintings. Charlie Rich is at the piano.
Pictures and paintings are etched in my heart for a love with no ending that never had a chance to start. Now all I am left with, all that I have, are pictures and paintings etched to my heart.
Pictures. Charlie Rich, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to be here.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. Maybe we can start with your childhood. You grew up, I believe, on a family plantation?
Yes, that's right.
So your family owned a plantation in Arkansas?
Yes. It was actually a rental type thing. My father was a planter, and he rented like about 3,000 acres of land and farmed it. I guess that's probably where I first, you know, heard the blues that I still enjoy so much and everything, was on this plantation.
So you were exposed to black music from the people who worked on the plantation?
That's true.
How did you make friends with the people there? I assume that they were older than you were.
Well, they... You know, some were older, some weren't. The one of my main people was a guy named C.J., and he kind of taught me some blues licks, and I used to sit and watch him play piano and that sort of thing. And he was kind of a honky-tonk piano player for the time. And of course, there was quite a few blues things around Memphis, which the plantation was over in Arkansas, but it's only about 30 miles from Memphis. So Memphis had a pretty good blues thing to start with, you know.
Did you go to black churches and listen to the music there?
Well, didn't really have to go. I did, but, you know, you could hear it like on a Sunday, or if you're riding your horse down the path or whatever, you could hear the black music come from the black churches. And as a matter of fact, in the cotton fields and that sort of thing, you could hear the singing and the something that was contagious, kind of.
Now, I believe your parents were Baptist missionaries?
That's true.
And they sang in a gospel quartet. What did they think of you learning the blues? Did they object to that?
No, they did not. No. As a matter of fact, my father and the sharecropper I was telling you about, C.J., they used to get together for, some Saturday night sessions. My dad played guitar and C.J. played piano and that sort of thing. So there was no racist thing or any of that to speak of, even though the times were that way. In our particular situation, it just never occurred that way.
So did you ever sing gospel music yourself?
Well, of course, when we went to church and that sort of thing, I sang what I guess we consider now white gospel music, which is, in a sense, kind of like the quartet-type singing. My mother played piano, my dad sang, and two or three of their friends sang, and kind of, they did a lot of churches, and they did some radio shows and things like that, and they took me one time to a little station in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and I was supposed to sing, and they put a chair under me so I could reach up to the mic, but I never did sing. I was shell-shocked or something, mic-shocked maybe. But anyway, the quartet was performing, and I was supposed to sing a thing myself, but I couldn't get any sound to come out.
How old were you?
And I still, in a sense, sometimes have a problem with that.
How old were you when this happened?
Oh, I was about 5 or 6.
When you actually started performing, was stage fright ever a serious problem?
Well, I think so, yes. I don't know if that's... I don't know whether it's that or, like, anxiety or some of the new names they have for things now, but... like, once the ball's kicked off, everything's fine, but before that, it's a little nerve-wracking, yes.
Right.
Still, it's anxiety panic disorder, I think is what they call it now.
Charlie Rich is my guest. From his latest recording, Pictures and Paintings, this is his version of the song, You Don't Know Me.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello. I can hardly speak, my heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me. Oh, you don't know the one that thinks of you at night, longs to kiss your lips, longs to squeeze you tight. To you I'm just a friend, that's all I've ever been. You just don't know me.
Now what about piano? How did you start playing? Was there a piano in your house?
We had a piano in the house, and my mother played. I have two sisters, and they both took piano lessons, and I took from about the third grade till about the ninth grade, and then decided I wanted to play football, and I did that, and in the meantime, I was learning to play saxophone in the band, and only after I got back into the, when I went into the Air Force, did I actually start playing piano again, as professionally, so to speak.
You were in an Air Force band?
Yes, in Enid, Oklahoma.
Now, I think your first real professional break came when your wife, Margaret Ann, took a tape of your songs to the Sun Studios in Memphis. And I was wondering if she did that secretly or if you knew that she was going to do that.
She did it secretly. At that time, we had just gotten out of the... because we got married while I was in the Air Force. And I was 19, and she was 18, and we didn't have anything to do, and we had two kids and another one on the way, and I was getting out of the Air Force, so I didn't have a check coming in, so my uncle set me up in the farming business over across the river in West Memphis, and that... is where I was doing some stuff just at home and putting it on a little Webcore recorder, and she took some of it secretly over to Bill Justice at Sun Record Company, and he gave her, he was nice to her and everything, but he gave her a Jerry Lee Lewis record and said, go tell Charlie when he can play that bad, come see me. Because Jerry was real hot at the time, you know.
Yeah, and Sun was the studio that had Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins. Would you have had the nerve to take that tape to Sun yourself?
Well, at the time, I was busy, like, you know, with another occupation or trying to be. And I didn't really know that much about the recording industry and that sort of thing. If it hadn't been for my wife, probably the tape would never have gotten to Bill, and I don't know where I'd be now. I may be driving a tractor or something.
Right. Well, the first record that you made for Sun Studios. It was a song of yours called Lonely Weekends.
Right.
And you recorded it in 1950.
60, wasn't it?
Excuse me?
59 or 60?
I'm sorry. You recorded it in 1959. How did you get to record this?
I had written that song, and as we got the ball rolling, so to speak, Sam got interested in the stuff we were writing more so than being an artist. And I think I wrote that for Elvis or Jerry Lee or whoever would cut it, probably. And I guess we got a pretty good demo on it. And so Sam decided we'd cut it on me, and we did, and ended up getting a good cut. And it was the first record that we had out that, you know, that did quite well for us back, I think it was 1959 or 60.
Let me play it. And this is Charlie Rich, Lonely Weekends.
I'll make it all right.
We'll make it all right.
From Monday morning to Friday night.
Oh, those
lonely weekends.
Since you left me,
I'm as lonely as I can be.
Oh, those lonely weekends.
Said you'd be good to me.
Listening to that, it sounds like you were a little influenced in your singing back then by Elvis Presley. Did you think of yourself as being influenced by him then?
Back then, everybody, in a sense, tried to, if, you know, they tried to either write something that Elvis would like or would do or would maybe even, you know, imitate him if they could to some degree. And being it was my first time out, I didn't know, I guess, what else to do. I don't think jazz was selling real great about that time. But so I think, in a sense, he set a style that a lot of different people, including myself, tried to imitate to some degree, knowingly or unknowingly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlie Rich, and he has a new recording out called Pictures and Paintings. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Rich is joining us. In the 1970s, you hooked up with the record producer Billy Sherrill, and he produced your really big hits, like The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors. How did you meet up with him and start working with him?
I had met Billy before as an engineer for Sun Records in Nashville. Sam also had a studio in Nashville, so we went over there one time and recorded some things, and Billy was the engineer on the session, so that's really the first place I met him. Next time I met him, he was kind of the head producer over at Epic Records in Nashville. And we worked together for about 3 or 4 years. And we did stuff like, you say, The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors and I Take It On Home and quite a few different things. And some worked and some didn't, but those were the biggest selling records. And of course, that meant, you know, overseas tours and moving around a lot. And finally, we even played Las Vegas quite a bit and places like that. So it just led to quite a bit of work.
Well, I want to play The Most Beautiful Girl, and I have to tell you that, you know, I just recently went back and listened to this record again, and you sing so soulfully on it. You really sing beautifully on it. I'll confess that when it was a hit, I used to just, like, hear it in the background a lot, and I wouldn't always, you know, pay that careful attention to it, like one does with a lot of hits, you know, that you're just hearing, like, on jukeboxes and in stores and in the background on the radio. But you really sing so well on it.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you.
So let's give this a spin.
Okay.
And this is Charlie Rich, one of his big hits, The Most Beautiful Girl.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying, crying? Hey, if you happen to see the most beautiful girl that walked out on me, tell her I'm sorry. Tell her I need my baby. Oh, won't you tell her that I love her?
Did you feel that you fit in with the country music crowd in the 70s?
Well, I traveled with country music folk and played country music shows and auditoriums, and I liked country music, but that wasn't all that I liked. And I still think there's some great country records out there, and some good things come out of country music. I just can't seem to just stay in one particular thing, because I feel like it kind of makes me stale if I try to stay in one particular category. And so I venture out on a lot of new things. Some work, some don't.
In 1974, you won the Country Music Award for Entertainer of the Year. And in the next year, 1975, you were presenting the award to the winner, and you opened up the envelope, which revealed that the winner was John Denver. So what you did was you took out your cigarette lighter and burned the piece of paper that announced who the winner was. What was going through your mind when you did that?
It's kind of strange. There were a lot of, on that particular instance, there were a lot of people asking me if it was a form of rebellion or what have you, or something of that nature, or if I didn't like John Denver, or if... But actually, that wasn't the situation at all. Things at those awards shows and things can get pretty hectic in the back before you even go on stage and what have you. And it seems like millions of people running around back there and that sort of thing. And I guess my anxiety panic disorder kicked in or something. But there was no intent as far as trying to make a statement. It was just kind of a mistake, but, you know, I've made a few before.
Well, no matter how it was intended, I'm sure a lot of people interpret it as a slam to John Denver. I was wondering if there were any consequences that you suffered as a result of having, you know, done this at the Country Music Awards.
Well, I don't know. It may have... it's hard to say exactly. It may have been that I had been overworked in 73, 74, 75, and that sort of thing. And maybe I was rebelling, but not against John Denver and not against country music. It was just, like I say, it was just a mistake that I made that I guess was important. But actually, I think everything works to the good, so... maybe I was saying, well, I want to try something else besides country or something. I don't know.
So you think it was, in your own way, a way of getting out?
I think maybe so, yes.
Was that the result?
Well, it was. I kept on recording and went with another couple of labels and some different producers and that sort of thing, and we did... a lot of records, a lot of writing, and the same things that we'd been doing. Not many being successful, and we tried doing some, you know, strictly country-type stuff, and I just said that I don't want to just do just country-type stuff the rest of my life. I want to do some different things. And so that's kind of where I am now, I guess. And Peter Guralnick and Joe McEwen gave me that opportunity with this album, so... that's kind of the result.
On the back of your new compact disc, there's a picture of your hands on the piano, and you're holding a cigarette in one of your hands.
Right.
You still smoke?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the engineer was kind enough to bring me an ashtray in a no-smoking area here where I'm talking to you. But I still do, and I don't recommend it to anybody, but... I don't know. It's just a thing I've done all my life, and
do you think it's affected your voice at all?
I don't know. I started to cut an album with a guy out in California one time, and I was trying to quit smoking, and he said that's doing something to your voice. It's not right. So I started smoking again, and have been ever since. And the album didn't do that well, so I guess maybe I should. Maybe I should keep on smoking.
Well, Charlie Rich, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, it's nice to talk to you.
Charlie Rich, I spoke with him last year following the release of his latest recording, Pictures and Paintings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You ain't been blue. No. That feeling goes stealing down to my shoes while I sit and sigh. Go. Can't get out of that mood indigo since my baby said goodbye. And in the evening when the lights are low, I get so lonesome I could cry.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the roots music and movie scores of Ry Cooder. He first became known for his bottleneck guitar playing. Now his most famous music is from his score for Paris, Texas, brooding guitar lines that have since been used for Molson beer commercials. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews Coneheads, another in a line of Saturday Night Live-inspired movies. This one stars Jane Curtin and Dan Aykroyd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee has completed its hearings on the nomination of Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the U.S. Supreme Court. On its fourth and final hearing day, the panel heard first from the nominee in closed session for about 20 minutes, and then from more than a dozen witnesses supporting and opposing the nominee. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Pro-life groups went to bat against Ginsburg today because of the nominee's support for abortion rights. The anti-abortion groups told the Judiciary Committee that a nominee not committed to preserving human life is not fit for the Supreme Court. But the groups didn't get to first base. The hearing room was almost completely empty, as a number of the anti-abortion spokespersons testified. And Republican Senator Orrin Hatch gently told them that given the fact that Bill Clinton had won the election, Judge Ginsburg was probably the best nominee they could hope for. When the hearing concluded, Chairman Joseph Biden announced that the committee would vote on Ginsburg's nomination next Thursday, with confirmation by the full Senate expected soon thereafter. So far, no senator has indicated any intention to vote against the Ginsburg nomination. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Capitol.
Joyce Lynn Elders, nominated to be U.S. Surgeon General at her confirmation hearing today, reaffirmed her support for sex education. She also defended her financial dealings and conceded that she and other directors of an Arkansas bank had been cited for management deficiencies, but said the charge was not criminal and that she was not targeted personally. The Senate has voted to require Congress to stop spending so much money on itself. In an 85-8 vote, the Senate agreed to a $31 million cut below the current budget for the legislative branch. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate tightened its own belt today, approving a $2.3 billion appropriation bill to run congressional offices and pay staff, operate the Library of Congress, and send out mailings to constituents. The overall funding level is 1.4% less than the fiscal 1993 figure and $370 million less than what was requested in President Clinton's budget. The reduction will result in the elimination of 248 congressional jobs. It's the second time the Senate has cut legislative spending, but senators rejected an amendment that would have eliminated money to pay for their free mass mailings. Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska protested, saying that elimination of the annual $36 million would be unfair to rural states. The Senate also vowed to cut back staff by 4% in 1995. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 21.5 points to close at 3,546.74 on volume of more than 218 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Senate Armed Services Committee has approved a policy on gays in the military that is in line with President Clinton's proposal. However, the committee version gives the military more latitude in ousting gay military members. Well, the panel said the military is to continue its practice of not asking about a personal sexual orientation. It said the Secretary of Defense could bring back the question if it was felt to be necessary for the good of the armed forces. The overall military spending bill also grants a 2.2% pay raise instead of freezing salaries as proposed by the president. Weather forecasters are predicting more heavy rainfall in the Midwest this weekend. That means the already swollen Mississippi and Missouri rivers could rise even higher. Donna Peck of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
Parts of the Midwest were pounded by up to 5 inches of rain last night, and 1.5 inches of rain has fallen on some areas of Missouri already today. Parts of Kansas and Missouri are under severe thunderstorm warnings this evening, and forecasters say heavy rains are expected all weekend. The Mississippi River had dropped 0.3 feet to 46.6 feet this morning in St. Louis, but meteorologist Steve Thomas says the predicted heavy rains this weekend are bound to swell the river. Thomas says the Mississippi can expect an up-and-down crest pattern for the next 10 days. The Mississippi is expected to climb to 47 feet again this weekend. The record of just over 47 feet was set on Tuesday of this week. For National Public Radio, I'm Donna Peck in Kansas City.
A Chinese airplane on a domestic flight has crashed in the northern part of the country, killing 59 people. According to Chinese news reports, the British Aerospace 146 was carrying more than 100 people and went down in its second takeoff attempt. One of those killed in the crash was said to be a British tourist. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. American roots music is Ry Cooder's specialty. He's made around 10 albums featuring his versions of blues, jazz, gospel, depression ballads, Tex-Mex, and rock and roll. He's an accomplished guitarist who first built his reputation on his bottleneck technique. He even plays blues mandolin. He did a lot of guitar session work before making his own records. It was Cooder on slide guitar on the Rolling Stones record Love in Vain. Cooder has also composed many movie scores for such films as The Long Riders, Southern Comfort, Streets of Fire, and Paris, Texas. More recently, he was in the band Little Village with John Hiatt, Nick Lowe, and Jim Keltner. Cooder is currently working on a new soundtrack album and doing session work and music for commercials. Our interview was recorded last year. We're featuring it today as part of our weekly edition of Fresh Air Favorites from the Archives. Let's get started with something from Cooder's first album. This is Brownsville.
I'm going to Brownsville, take that right-hand road. Well, I'm going to Brownsville, take that right-hand road.
Over the years, you've learned and played so many different kinds of music, all forms of blues, Tex-Mex, Hawaiian music. I'm wondering if there's a music that you consider to be your roots.
No, well, Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that, really. There's so much I've heard for so many years, although maybe Johnny Cash. I mean, the first thing I ever heard that I really related to on the radio as a child was Johnny Cash. I mean, after hearing Beethoven and stuff, but I can't say that Beethoven's a root guy for me. But, I mean, before Woody Guthrie is there, and there's a kind of a funny area of music hardly made anymore by marginal white people, that I really loved as a kid, which was this kind of country blues thing, and it's also played by black people, of course, you know. But I mean, early on, before I ever heard blues players, I heard Woody and I heard Johnny Cash, and I used to think, these guys are really, wherever they are, and I had no idea where they were. You know, I lived in Santa Monica, as far as I knew. This was what life was, and I had no idea, you know, that there was another world of culture or lifestyle out there. And, you know, I would have loved to have gone to these places, but the best thing I could do was turn on the radio at the time.
Do you think of yourself now as or have you thought of yourself over the years as a marginal white person?
Yeah, I sure do. I mean, I think that's the best place to be, is on the margin, out there on the periphery somewhere, hanging on, because it allows you to do two things. You can see in. You have a kind of a luxury if you're on the edge looking in. You can see the whole picture if you've trained yourself, or if you're in the habit of looking that way. And music's a way of seeing, you know. It's a way of understanding. people or situations or life or the world through the sound. If you listen in, you hear things other than notes, is all I'm saying. And the other good thing about being on the margin is you see out away from the middle. So you're sort of, you know, and you can drop off the planet a little once in a while and go see the Tex-Mex guys in McAllen, Texas, or the Hawaiian folks over there on the beach somewhere, you know, because you're not committed or you're not locked into a one way or another of seeing and thinking, you know. So I tend to stay on the edge, the periphery there, as long as it's possible anyhow.
How were you exposed to blues when you were growing up?
Well, it was hard to be exposed to blues living in Santa Monica, you see. There wasn't anybody playing blues. And then you could listen to radio station KGFJ. Hunter Hancock would once in a while sneak in a Jimmy Reed record or something like maybe Lowell Fulson or somebody. And so you said, well, that's different, that's interesting. And then along came the folk revival and the blues revival attached to it, like the baggage car, and or actually the coal car, the burner. And along came Chris Strachwitz, and he with our Hooli Records, and he found Lightning Hopkins for us and brought us, you know, he brought us in to see some people like that. And there was the Ash Grove, the nightclub in L.A. that featured some of these by then older guys who were still active. And as far as they were concerned, it was just another way of making some money, and another audience happened to be white. And of course, for me, it was tremendous just to get in a car and drive to Hollywood and see these guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Sleepy John Estes, just apparently from Mars or some planet where people look like this, talk like this, had strange clothes and shoes that turned up on the toes with the orange soles. I just could not imagine where these people were coming from, but you knew you wanted to go with them. It's Pied Piper-like thing, you know. I must have been about 12, 13 when all that started to happen.
Were you ever disappointed by how they sounded in person?
Oh, yeah. I wanted it to be just like the record. At first I did, anyhow. I thought, can't he play that lick I love so much? Then I learned, of course, that's not the way music works. That's not the way people work. See, it's an education there. And it was fun then to find that things could change and you didn't have to. In other words, it wasn't just a matter of recreating. If you wanted to experience this music, you weren't really supposed to recreate in yourself what had happened at that moment in time in, say, 1929 or 1940 or something. You were just supposed to just learn to surf across the wave of this thing, you know, just catch the groove. But nobody can tell you that. You have to kind of feel that for yourself, you know.
Early in your career, you did some session work with groups like Paul Revere and the Raiders, and they had the hits like Kicks and Good Thing, mm-hmm. and Jackie DeShannon, who recorded What the World Needs Now, and you were on one of the Stones records doing some studio work. How did you get from, you know, the folk scene to studio work?
Yeah. Well, that was quite a leap, although it wasn't the leap it is now. I mean, I guess what happened was there was suddenly a moment when folk rock was viable commercially, you know. It, I guess thanks to Bob Dylan and then the Byrds, and this all hit in L.A. like a ton of bricks. I mean, it really went off. It set a lot of flares up, see, and suddenly everybody was into music and the Beatles and everything. And I went to Santa Monica High School, you know. Music was considered just as ridiculous. It was absolutely déclassé, outré thing to be interested in, even talk about, until the Beatles had their hit, and then everybody started letting their hair grow and talking about this stuff. I mean, it was like a social fact. It was like an atmosphere in your life that was never to go away. So I was, of course, very contemptuous. I thought, you know, these people just don't understand. We already knew that, you know, this stuff is already out there. So since I had no, I didn't relate to what was going on in school and things, and so I used to hang out with musicians who were older and hung out at these little folk clubs and stuff. And by, Taj Mahal appeared on the scene. He came out from Cambridge. We would sit around and play, and we liked the same stuff. So he said, well, look, these guys, the Byrds, they're working. There's Bob Dylan's, he's working, you know, let's us work. And so we went to Ed Pearl, who ran the Ash Grove, and said, here we are, and give us a job. And he did, naturally. You know, didn't pay us anything, but said, open for somebody, you know, just do some songs. And then we did that. And then make a long, pretty long story, a little shorter, we went on, and the record companies had awakened to the fact that they might have somebody out there, there might be something they could do, and turn this sort of folk garage band thing into product, you know, and we got signed to Columbia Records, and we had this band, and it was terrible. But it was really no good for anything except that it got us in the door at the record company, which in those days, that door was big and it was closed.
My guest is guitarist and singer Rye Cooter. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Rye Cooter is my guest. I think your best-known soundtrack is what you wrote for Paris, Texas. And you wrote this really kind of lonely, brooding kind of blues, but very, very kind of spacious, with lots of space between notes, lots of just notes resonating. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit how it certainly matches the mood of the movie? It's a pretty perfect fit, but maybe you could tell us a little bit how you came up with the sound for that film. Actually, before you tell us, why don't I play the most familiar part of that soundtrack? So maybe now you could tell us a little bit about, you know, creating that kind of mood musically.
Well, Wim called me up.
This is Wim Wenders, the director.
Wim Wenders, the director, called me from Berlin. He said he'd made a film. He wanted me to do the music. He'd see me in 3 days. So he came out to, and that was about all he said. He came out to Los Angeles, and he was in somebody's house, and he had this thing on video cassette, this film, Paris, Texas, which I knew nothing about, and went up there and took a look at it. With no music, just the empty, silent kind of strange interior monologue that this thing is, and I thought, well, Lord, you know, this is great, and it's very beautiful, and what? Hopefully, he'll know what he wants. You see, because it could go, you could do. People, you never know what directors are thinking, because you hope that they're thinking of something, but if they are, they better let you know, and it's important to pick up on the right thing so you don't go wasting everybody's time. So anyhow, he had found this Blind Willie Johnson piece. Actually, I had recorded it some years back, called Dark as the Night, which is a kind of a modal study. It's just a bottleneck song that Blind Willie, it's the music of the spheres. I mean, it's some sort of root note thing. It's some sort of cosmic mood piece that the great Blind Willie Johnson had laid down for all time. And as far as Wim Wenders is concerned, this was the territory to be in. This was the place to go for this guy, because it was going to be the music of the man, the Harry Dean Stanton character, Travis, what it was like to be in his head, you know, not to say that he goes around whistling this thing, but that he's coming from a place where things, if they had a musical identity, this is what it would be, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing outside in this film except empty space, the sky and the ground and the railroad tracks. So you have to say, well, we're operating in some other conscious area here, you know. So we can't be too linear, we can't be too lyrical. If you have a lot of counterpoint, a lot of rhythm, and a lot of musical ideas going on, it's just going to turn this little film over and sink it. See, it's going to be like you're going to rock the boat too hard in a very sensitive situation. So I figured he knew what he wanted, and I could hear this piece, and what I did was I kind of broke it down to some even simpler elements, maybe four-note element, and began to take that little theme, as it were, and try to develop it in a way that it could be heard or felt, hopefully not as somebody thinking real hard, and hopefully not as somebody reacting real hard and using all their brain. And what you want to do in a situation like this is turn your brain off, you know, people say, oh, you're not using your brain here. Well, you can't operate with in this way if you're using your brain too hard, because you're just thinking and thinking and thinking. So you want to shut it off and get to the thing that you feel, you know.
I think it was Molson's who used your theme for their beer yeah. commercial.
That's right.
So they must have come to you and asked for permission to use it. You had to sell it to them, right?
Actually, what I did was I went and played it, and I played it again. And of course, now I don't do this as a rule, but you know, I thought, well, let's try it and see. It got to be where people were. They still do want to use this thematic little thing. This little it's almost a cliche now. You want to hear this guitar out there with the kind of drone underneath, and I've had to, you know. Had to receive the requests from cigarette companies and automobiles and cars and clothes, and they want to sell a lot of stuff with this, which is very odd because you certainly never had that in mind. And it's, you know, it's not the most unpackaged sound I can make, and yet right. It's the one that the packagers like the best. Isn't that odd? Isn't that strange?
Are you glad that you did this for Molson's? Has it helped you a lot financially in a good way and given you more freedom? Where do you draw the line about when to and when not to use music for a commercial?
No, the Molson thing was a fee job. It was a very small fee. It was very small, and it's money I probably put into the yard. You know, got some a bigger lemon tree or something. And you know, you spend that money, and then you don't even remember what those
I thought
deals
you would have made
don't...
a fortune on that. They've used
no,
it so
no,
much.
No. I'm afraid not. I wouldn't mind making some real good money on an easy job. Although the more I try to do that stuff, the harder, you know. You can't go and do it for other reasons. It doesn't quite work. The truth of the matter is that. The real rich advertising money comes from something I don't know what. It certainly wasn't Molson's. I guarantee you that.
Guitarist and singer Ry Cooter, as recorded in May of last year. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about the confirmation hearings of Joycelyn Elders, President Clinton's nominee to be Surgeon General of the United States. We'll also be hearing about scandals in Italy and how they've led to suicides, two this week by Italian businessmen who are implicated in various scandals. News also of the problems faced by Brazil's street children. And we'll also be hearing about the economic problems of American companies, in this case, a small business that makes gaskets for spark plugs that relies on foreign steel, and how they might be affected by the new duties placed on imported steel. And Bob Garfield goes celebrity fishing, not fishing for celebrities, but fishing with them. Coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The new Coneheads movie starring Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin just opened. It's based on the sketch they originated on Saturday Night Live in the 70s about an extraterrestrial family that winds up living in suburbia, trying to act normal, consuming mass quantities of junk food. Critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Coneheads is a real surprise. Watching it, you can't believe how thin it always is. Dan Aykroyd and Saturday Night Live writer Tom Davis dreamed up these characters 17 years ago. And obviously haven't thought about him much since Aykroyd left the show in 1979. But when Wayne's World became a hit, all the old SNL characters were up for re-exploitation, at least the ones played by actors who aren't real busy right now. The Conehead family's story of involuntary exile on this planet is one version of the modern pop myth. It's the story of the man who fell to Earth, of Superman, Sun Ra, and my favorite Martian. The Coneheads movie was directed by Steve Barron, who made the first Ninja Turtles picture, and he doesn't fill in much detail about the culture of the planet Remulac or the lives of Beldar and Primat before they crash-landed on Earth. Instead, they're being chased by a stock government bad guy, an immigration op played with conscientious gusto by Michael McKean. Daughter Connie Conehead, now played by Michelle Burke, is much more the typical Earth teenager who thinks her parents are square. The original Connie, Lorraine Newman, is around for about 4 seconds. As usual, the humorless and often hostile Coneheads blend in with Earthlings with all the grace of a foreign tourist in a small town. They run into scores of Saturday Night Livers, past and present, conspicuously David Spade and Chris Farley, and into other NBC regulars. Here's Aykroyd and Jane Curtin interacting with their suburban neighbors, played by Lisa Jane Persky and Seinfeld's Jason Alexander.
Bill Nye, is that you?
Correct.
Bill. Right. Yeah, buddy, you got a minute?
Of course.
The damn lawnmower won't start. You know, you're so darn good with machinery. Would you mind taking a look at it?
I do not mind.
Greetings, Lisa. Ah, excellent crop of decorative growth.
You're being nice.
Yes.
Standard 3 horsepower, internal combustion, chlorophyll stock slicer. There is fuel in the device.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of gas in there. I just can't get the damn thing to kick over.
Perhaps you and Larry will join us for consumption of mass quantities this weekend. We will ignite our new flame pit and char some mammal flesh for you.
That sounds like fun. I'll make some coleslaw.
Ah, coleslaw. We will enjoy it.
That really catches the movie's headlong pace and crackling wit. Coneheads is never as stupid as that business in Jurassic Park, where the fuse box for the control room is 3 miles out in the jungle. But it doesn't comb the immigrant experience or anything else for real laughs. It plods along like Beldar, a character who encases Dan Aykroyd like cement. The Dragnet remake was a lousy movie, but Aykroyd's Jack Webb imitation was so uncannily detailed you could watch just that. Putting Beldar on the big screen just shows how little texture he had all along. They were all more real on TV. It's only when the Coneheads return to planet Remulac that the movie comes alive for a few minutes. According to publicity, Aykroyd and Tom Davis thought up these characters after visiting Easter Island. You see the connection on Remulac, finally glimpsing a genuinely alien sensibility. The ornate capital looks like something out of a Terry Gilliam movie, Brazil, or The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. What Coneheads needed was a director like that, someone with an eye for rhyming imagery, a director who might have made something of the resemblance between the cone and the egg that hatched Ridley Scott's Alien. That version of Coneheads would have been more expensive, but maybe Jane Curtin wouldn't have looked so embarrassed all the time.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic and record annotator living in New York. He also reviews jazz recordings for Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Weinstein, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Barney Frank is one of two openly gay United States congressmen. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk to the Massachusetts representative about President Clinton's new policy on gays in the military. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.